rasped. "Hell's bells, man, it's me!" Thomas growled lower, but he didn't pancake my skull or stick something sharp and metal into my brain. Thomas was strong, stronger than me. A vampire of the White Court can bring out that kind of strength only on special occasions, but Thomas was a very well-fed vampire. I knew that if he wanted to do it, winter night steroids or no, he could twist me like a congressman's logic. "Molly!" he called out. "I know you're out there. I can smell you." A few seconds later, there were soft steps on the gangplank, and then the shadows moved at the door.
"I'm here."
"What the fuck is this?" he demanded.
"I'm not sure," Molly said. "It's dark, but if I could see, I'd tell you that I try not to put myself between two siblings when they're fighting. It never seems to help."
Two or three flabbergasted seconds passed. Then the pressure against my skull was gone so fast that I all but fell over. I grabbed myself before I could and shook my head.
"Ow. Nice to see you again, too, man."
He moved silently across the cabin and something clicked. A battery-powered tap light came to life, bringing a dim, if adequate, level of light to the compartment. My brother was a hair shy of 6 feet tall. He looked much as I remembered him. Dark, glossy hair fell to his shoulders. His skin was even paler than mine. His eyes were storm cloud gray, though they looked brighter than that now, glinting with little metallic flecks that revealed his anxiety and anger. He and I shared a similar scowl, all dark brows and intense eyes, and his mouth was twisted into a silent snarl as he stared at me. He was wearing a pair of jeans, and that was it. The cabin's bunk had been folded down and slept in. I'd woken him when I came aboard. In his right hand he held a metal tent stake. There was both dirt and rust on it. "Can you get gangrene in your brain?"
"Oh," Molly said. She stared at Thomas for a moment. "Oh, my."
"Oh, I forgot to mention it. My brother is the kind of man whom women stalk in cooperative packs. I'd say he was model pretty, except that as far as I could tell, there weren't any models as pretty as he was. He had muscles that rippled even when he was motionless and relaxed, and it was utterly unfair. And I didn't do a lot of appraising myself in the mirror, typically, but I suddenly realized that sometime in the past few years, Thomas had stopped looking like my older brother. He looked younger than me. Wizards can live a long time, but we don't look youthful while we do it. Thomas was a vampire. He'd look this good until he stopped breathing.
The guy barely works out, eats whatever he wants, and gets to look that good and young his whole life. How is that fair?
"You can't be my brother," Thomas said, staring hard at me. "My brother is dead. You know how I know." "Thomas," I began.
"Because my brother would have contacted me," Thomas snarled. "If he were alive, he would have gotten in touch with me. He would have let me know."
Molly winced and looked away, as though she'd just heard a very loud and very unpleasant sound. I'm not sensitive to the emotions of others the way Molly is, but I didn't need to be to know that Thomas was boiling over in reaction to seeing me there.
"I'm sorry, Harry," Molly said. "I can't. It hurts."
"Go," I said softly. She nodded and withdrew onto the deck of the boat, shutting the door behind her. My brother stayed where he was, staring at me.
"All this time," he said, "and not a word."
"I was dead," I said quietly, "or the next best thing to it. Maybe it was more like a coma. Hell, I thought I was dead."
"When did you wake up?"
he asked. His voice was carefully neutral.
"About 3 months ago," I said. "Wasn't in good shape. I've been recovering since then."
3 months, he said. "No phones there?"
"No, actually. I was in a cave on the island for a while, then Arctis Tor."
"No way for you to make contact?"
he asked calmly.
"You?"
Silence fell heavily. Thomas knew the kinds of things I could do. If I want someone to get a message, I can generally make sure it gets done, one way or another. "What do you want me to say, man?" I responded. "I sold out, Thomas."
"Yeah, when you hurt your back. You told us, for Maggie, to get her home safe."
"Right." He was silent for a second, then he said,
"Empty night. Why didn't I put that together?"
He sighed.
"Let me guess. You tried to kill yourself after she was home safe, right?"
I snorted through my nose. "Something like that." He shook his head in silence for several seconds. Then he took a deep breath, looked up at me again, and said,
"You moron."
"Hey," I said.
"You idiot."
"Damn it, Thomas," I spat. "I haven't lived my life the way I have to watch myself get turned into a..." I broke off suddenly and looked away.
"Into what, Harry?" he asked. "Say it."
I shook my head.
"No, you don't get a pass on this one, little brother," Thomas said. "Say it."
"Into a monster," I snapped.
"Right," Thomas said. "A monster, like me."
"That isn't what I meant."
"It is exactly what you meant," he spat, angry. "You arrogant."
He flung the tent spike in a fit of pure frustration. It tumbled end over end once and sank 2 inches into a wooden beam.
"You are going to be tempted, huh? Going to have to deal with monstrous urges? Going to have to face the possibility that you might change if you lost focus for a minute? Lose control of yourself? Maybe hurt somebody you care about?"
He shook his head.
"Cry me a fucking river, man. Boo fucking who."
I couldn't look at him.
"You'd rather be dead than like me," he said. "That's one hell of a thing to say to your brother."
"It wasn't about that," I said.
"It kinda was," he snapped back. "Damn it, Harry."
"I can't go back and change it," I said. "Maybe I would if I could, but it's done. I'm sorry, but it is."
"You should have talked to me," he said.
"Thomas."
"You should have trusted me," he said. "Damn it, man."
The memory of those desperate hours hit me hard. I felt so helpless. My daughter had been taken away from her home, and for all the times I had gone out on a limb for others, no one had seemed willing to do the same for me. The White Council, for whom I had fought a war, had turned its back on me. Time had been running out, and the life of a little girl who had never known her father was on the line. "Why?" I asked him tiredly. "What would it have changed? What could you possibly have said that would have made a difference?"
"That I was your brother, Harry," he said. "That I loved you. That I knew a few things about denying the dark parts of your nature. And that we would get through it."
He put his elbows on his knees and rested his forehead on his hands.
"That we'd figure it out. That you weren't alone."
Stab. Twist. He was right. It was just that simple. My brother was right. I had been self-involved and arrogant. Maybe it was understandable, given the pressures on me at the time, but that didn't mean I hadn't made bad calls of colossal proportion. I should have talked to him, trusted him. I hadn't even tried to consider anyone other than Maggie, hadn't even thought to start seeking support from my family. I'd just moved right along to the part of the plan where I hired one of the world's premier supernatural assassins to whack me. That probably said something about the state of despair I'd been in at the time. But it didn't say as much as I had about my brother. He was right about that, too. It wasn't something I had ever consciously faced before, but I had told Thomas, with my actions, that it was better to be dead than a monster like him. And actions speak far more loudly than words. I always thought it would get easier to be a person as I aged, but it just gets more and more complicated. "I'm sorry. I should have talked to you then," I said. My voice sounded hoarse. "I should have talked to you 3 months ago, but I couldn't because I made the wrong call."
I didn't think I should contact anyone.
Why not?
He asked, looking up. Because I didn't deserve to do it, I said quietly. Because I sold out. Because I was ashamed. He came to his feet, angry.
Oh, absolutely, I get that. I mean, you had to stay away. Otherwise, we all would have known that you aren't perfect, you gawking, stupid, arrogant, egotistical.
He hit my chest and wrapped his arms around me so hard that I felt my ribs creaking.
Clumsy, short-tempered, exasperating, goofy, useless.
I hugged my brother back and listened to a steady string of derogatory adjectives until he finished it.
Asshole.
Yeah, I said. I missed you too.
Chapter 15. Thomas got us to the island, navigating by the stars. I kept checking the ship's compass. Not because I didn't trust my brother, but because I had no freaking idea how he managed to keep the water beetle on course without one. Molly had spent the first part of the trip down in the cabin, wrapped up in some blankets. It was a chilly night out on the lake. Thomas and I were comfortable in shirts. I suspected my apprentice was still feeling the after effects of standing too close to my reunion with Thomas. I filled Thomas in on recent events on the way out, omitting only the details on the immortal killing thing. I had a sinking feeling that knowing something that important about beings that powerful was an excellent way to get yourself killed horribly on any night of the year that wasn't Halloween.
Yeah, Thomas said when I finished the briefing. Have you seen her yet?
I scowled. Seen who?
You tell me, he said.
Just you and Molly, I said. He gave me a look of profound disappointment and shook his head.
Thanks, Dad, I said.
You're alive, he said. You owe it to her to go see her.
Maybe when this is done, I said.
You might be dead by then, he said.
Empty night, Harry. Didn't your little adventure on the lake teach you a damn thing?
I scowled some more.
Like what?
Like life is short, he said.
Like you don't know when it's going to end.
Like some things left unsaid can't ever be said, he sighed.
I'm a freaking vampire, man.
I rip out pieces of people's souls and eat them and make them happy to have it happen. I didn't say anything. That was what my brother was. He was more than that, too, but it would have been stupid to deny that part of him.
I'm mostly a monster, he said. And even I know that she deserves to hear you tell her you love her, even if she never gets anything more than that.
I frowned. Wait, who are we talking about here?
Either, he said. Stop being an idiot. Stop flagellating yourself about how you endanger her by being in her life. You're the only you in her life, Harry. Believe me, they don't make replacements for a guy like you.
They don't make replacements for anybody, I said tiredly. We'll see. Thomas looked at me like he wanted to push, but he didn't.
So what about you? I asked. Justine and her playmate keeping you company?
Playmates, Thomas said absently, plural.
Totally not fair.
Huh, I said. He frowned.
Hey, how did you know about that?
Ghost me was there the night Justine decided she'd had enough of you moping, I said.
Ghost you was there for how long, exactly? He asked.
I left before it got to an NC-17.
He snorted.
Yeah, well, Justine has sort of become a dietitian.
What?
He shrugged.
You are what you eat, right? Same principle applies to vampires. Justine thinks I'm sad, she brings home someone happy. She thinks I'm too tense, someone laid back and calm.
He pursed his lips.
Really, it's been kind of nice. Balanced, like.
His eyes narrowed and flickered through a few paler shades.
And I get to be with Justine again. Even if it was hell, that would make it worthwhile.
Dude, I said, making the word a disgusted sound. Single guys everywhere hate you, starting with me.
I know, right? He said, nodding and smiling. Then he looked ahead and pointed. There, see it?
I peered ahead into the black and found a giant block of more solid black. We were at the island. The cabin door opened and Molly emerged, the blanket still wrapped around her shoulders. Her face still looked drawn, but not as pale as it had before we left the marina. She came up the steps to the top of the wheelhouse and stood beside me.
Thomas, she asked, why were you down at the boat tonight?
Thomas blinked and looked at her. What do you mean?
I mean, why were you sleeping on board?
Because you didn't tell me what time you'd be there, and I got sleepy, he said. Molly glanced aside at Thomas and then at me.
I asked you to do it?
Yeah, Thomas said, snorting. You called around 10. Molly kept looking at me, frowning.
No, I didn't.
Thomas promptly cut the throttle on the boat. The water beetle began coasting to a halt, and the sound of the water hitting her hull resurfaced as the rattle of her engines died.
Okay, Thomas said. What the hell is going on, then?
Molly, I said, are you sure?
None of my issues have included memory loss or unconscious actions, she said.
Thomas squinted back at her. If they had, how would you know it? Molly frowned.
Valid point, but there's been no evidence of that, to my knowledge. I'm as confident about that as anything else I perceive.
So if Molly didn't call me, Thomas began.
Who did? I finished.
Water slapped against the hull.
What do we do? Molly asked.
If someone set us up to be here, Thomas said, it's a trap.
If it's a trap, they sure as hell didn't try very hard to hide it, I said. All we really know is that someone wanted us here.
Molly nodded.
Do you think
Mab's work? I asked. Having my ride prepared?
Yeah, maybe.
If your new boss wanted you on the island, wouldn't she just have told you to go there? Thomas asked.
Seems like, I said. Taking her orders is pretty much my job now.
Molly snorted softly.
Maybe I'll grow into it, I said. You don't know.
Thomas snorted softly. More water sounds.
We didn't have a lot of choice, really. Whether or not we'd been manipulated into showing up, there was still a giant potential problem with the island, something that had to be addressed as soon as possible. If I waited, dawn would be upon us, and it was entirely possible I'd be too busy, or dead, to fix the problem before it went boom. Which meant that the only time I had to take real action was right now.
Just once, I growled. I'd like to save the goddamn day without a shot clock, you know?
The monster business is an easier gig, Thomas said, nodding. Way, way easier.
Which was my brother's backhanded way of telling me what he thought of me.
I think we all know I'm not smart enough for that, I said.
Eyes open, everyone.
Thomas, pull her up to the dock. Let's see who's waiting for us.
The island had once been host to a small town back in the late 19th century. It had been home to docks, warehouses, and what might have been a fishery or cannery or something. Probably no more than a couple of hundred people had lived there at most. But the people weren't there anymore, and what was left of the town was like some kind of skeleton lying among the trees that had grown up through the floorboards. I don't know what happened to the town. Stories from the time mention only mysterious events in the lake and an influx of new customers to what passed for a psychiatric care facility at the time. The town itself had been expunged from any records, and not even its name remained to be found. The island, likewise, had vanished from the official record, though if I had to guess, I would say that the reigning authorities at the time decided that covering up the island's existence was the best way to protect people from exposure to it. Actually, knowing what I know now, I'd guess that the island made them come to that conclusion. The island I'd named Demon Reach was very much alive. Most of the world is, actually. People think that civilization and organized religion have somehow erased the spirits that exist in nature, in all the world. They haven't. People aren't the omnipotent force for destruction that we arrogantly believe we are. We can change things, true, but we never really destroyed those old spirits and presences of the wild. We aren't that powerful. We are very loud and very self-involved, though, so most people never really understand when they're in the presence of a spirit of the land, with what the old Romans called a genus loci. So, naturally, they also didn't understand when they were in the presence of a truly powerful spirit of the land, a potent spirit like that of, say, Vesuvius, or Demon Reach. I'd been to the island on most weekends up until I got shot, and Thomas had often come with me. We'd used some fresh lumber, some material salvaged from the ruined town, and some pontoons made from plastic sheathing and old tractor tire inner tubes, to construct a floating walkway to serve as a dock, anchored to the old pilings that had once supported a much larger structure. Upon completion, I had dubbed it the What's Up Dock, and Thomas had chucked me 20 feet out into the lake, thus proving his utter lack of appreciation for reference-oriented humor. And I'd thrown him 40 feet out with magic once I got dry. Because come on, he's my brother. It was the only thing to do. The water beetle came drifting slowly into the dock and bumped it gently. You had to be a little bit nimble to get over the side of the boat and onto the floating dock. But fortunately for me, you didn't need to be a gymnast. We'd limned the outer boards of the floating dock in phosphorescent paint, and in the darkness it was a gently glowing, clearly visible outline. I hit the dock and secured the first line on the ring we'd installed, then walked down the dock and caught the second when Thomas threw it to me. Once the boat had been made fast, Thomas lowered the gangplank, a pirate's life for me, and Molly padded down it. Thomas came last, buckling on his gun belt, which was currently hung with his ridiculously huge desert eagle just in case we were attacked by a rabid Cape buffalo and a big old bolo-style machete. Watching him put the weapons on, I started to feel a little bit naked. I didn't have any of my usual gear, and I'd survived a bunch of nasty situations because I'd had it. I rubbed my hands against the thighs of my jeans, scowling, and tried not to think of how the only gear I had consisted of a messenger bag and a talking skull. Thomas noticed. Oh, hey, you need a piece, man? They're just so fashionable, I said. He slipped back aboard and came out with a freaking relic. He tossed it to me. I caught it, frowning. It was a repeating rifle, a Winchester, complete with a large, rounded hoop handle on the lever action. It was seriously heavy, with an octagonal barrel, walnut wood fixtures, and shining brass housing. Elkhorn sights. The gun had a certain comforting mass to it, and I felt like even if it ran out of ammunition, I would still be holding a seriously formidable club. Plus, whatever it was chambered in, a gun that heavy would hardly kick at all. It'd be more like handling a shotgun that pushed against your shoulder, rather than trying to jar it off. What am I? I complained. John Wayne? You aren't that cool, Thomas said. It's quick, easy to instinct shoot, and good to weigh out past the effective range of a handgun. Lever action, it'll be reliable. Keep working right through the apocalypse. Which was a point in its favor, the way my life had been lately. Rounds? Traditional 45 Colt, he said. Knock a big man down in one hit and keep him there. Catch. He tossed me an ammo belt, heavy with metallic shells that were nearly as big around as my thumb. I slung the belt across my chest, made sure the chamber was empty, but with a shell ready to be levered into it, and balanced the heavy gun up on one shoulder, keeping one hand on the stock. Molly sighed. Boys. Thomas hooked a thumb back at the boat. I got a machine gun you can have, Molly. Barbarian, she said. I don't raid a machine gun, I asked. No, you don't, Thomas said, because you can't shoot. I just gave you that to make you feel better. You ready? I asked them. Molly had her little wands out, one in each hand. Thomas swaggered down the gangplank and looked bored. I nodded at them, turned, and took several quick steps off the dock and onto the stony soil of the island. My link with the island was an extremely solid and powerful bond, but it existed only when I was actually standing on it. Now that I was, knowledge flooded into me, through me, a wave of absolute information that should have inundated my senses and disoriented me entirely, but it didn't. That was the beauty of Intellectus, pure, universal knowledge. While I stood on the island, I understood it in a way that was breathtakingly simple to experience and understand, but practically impossible to explain properly. Knowledge of the island just flowed into me. I could tell you how many trees stood upon the island, 17,429, how many had been taken down by the summer storms, 79, and how many of the apple trees currently bore fruit, 22. I didn't have to focus on an idea or wrest the knowledge from the island. I just thought about it and knew, the way I knew what my fingers were touching, the way I knew what scents belonged to what foods. We were alone on the island, that much I knew, but I could also sense a profound unease in the place. Molly's description had been perfectly accurate. Something was wrong. Some kind of horrible strain was upon the island, a pressure so pervasive that the trees themselves had begun to lean away from the island's heart, stretching their branches toward the waters of the lake. Without my heightened awareness of the island, I never would have been able to sense the shift of inches across thousands and thousands of branches, but it was real, and it was there. "We're clear," I said. "There's no one else out here."
"You're sure?" Thomas asked.
"I'm certain," I said, "but I'll stay alert. If I sense anyone showing up, I'll fire off a shot."
"Wait," Thomas said. "Where are you going?"
"Up the hill," I told him. Up to the tower, I think.
"Alone? You sure that's smart?" he asked.
Molly was standing at the end of the dock. She crouched down, reaching a hand out toward the dirt of the island. She brushed her fingers against it and then jerked them away with a shudder.
"Ugh, yes. We don't want to step off the dock. Not tonight."
I could hear Thomas's frown in his voice.
"Island's got its panties in a bunch, huh?"
"I think something bad would happen to us if we tried to go with him," Molly said, her voice troubled. "Whatever's happening, Demon Reach only wants Harry to see what's going on."
"Why doesn't it just marry him?" Thomas muttered under his breath.
"It sort of did," I said.
"My brother, the geosexual?"
I snorted. "Look, think of it as a business partner, and be glad it's on our side."
"It isn't on our side," Molly said quietly, "but I think it might be on yours."
"Same thing," I said warningly out at the island in general. "You hear that? They're my guests. Be nice." The thrumming tension in the island didn't change, not in the least. It went on with a kind of glacial inevitability that didn't give two shakes for the desires of one ephemeral little mortal, wizard or not. I got the feeling that nice simply wasn't in Demon Reach's vocabulary. I'd probably have to be satisfied with it refraining from violence.
"We'll talk," I said to the island, trying to make it a threat. Demon Reach didn't care.
I muttered under my breath, bounced the Winchester on my shoulder, and started walking. Walking on the island is an odd experience. I'd say it's like walking through your house in the dark, except I've never known a house as well as I knew that island. I knew where every stone lay, where every branch stuck out in my path, knew it without being warned by any senses at all. Walking in the dark was as easy as doing it in broad daylight, easier, even. I'd have had to pay at least a little attention to use my eyes, but here every step was solid, and every motion I made was minimal, efficient, and necessary. I made my way through unbroken brush in the dark, hardly making a sound, never tripping once. As I did, I noted that Molly had been right about another thing. The clash of energies in the air had created enough dissonance to drive away most of the animals, the ones that had the capacity to readily escape. The deer were gone. Birds and raccoons were gone, and so were the skunks. Though that would be one hell of a long swim to the nearest stretch of lakeshore, animals have been known to swim farther. Smaller mammals, mice and squirrels and so on, remained, though they had crowded into the 10 yards or so nearest the shoreline all around the island. The snakes were having a field day with that, and evidently weren't bright enough to know that there was a bigger problem brewing. I found the trail to the top of the hill, the high point on the island, and started up it. There were irregular steps cut into the hillside to make the ascent easier. They were treacherous if you didn't walk carefully, or if you didn't have near omniscience about the place. At the top of the hill is a ruined lighthouse made of stone. It's basically just a chewed-up silo shape now, having collapsed long ago. Next to the ruined tower, someone cobbled together a small cottage out of fallen stones. When I first saw it, it had been a square, squat little building with no roof. Thomas and I had been planning on putting the roof back on, so that I could overnight on the island someplace where we could build a fire and stay warm. But we hadn't gotten that far yet when everything had gone sideways. The cottage just sat, empty and forlorn. But a soft golden glow bathed the interior wall I could see from my position. There was a scent of wood smoke on the air. Someone had built me a fire. I made my way forward cautiously, looking around with both my awareness and my eyes, just in case my omniscience was in actuality nigh omniscience, but I couldn't sense any threat. So I went into the cabin and looked around. There was a fire in the fireplace, and a folding table stacked with thick plastic boxes containing jars of food that would stay good for months at a time. The boxes would resist the tampering of critters. There were some camp implements stored in another box, and I took the time to break out a metal coffee pot, went out to the little old iron pump just outside the front door, and filled it. I tossed in a couple of handfuls of coffee grounds, hung it on the swivel arm by the fireplace, and nudged it over the fire. Then I broke out the skull and set him down on the table. "Okay, Bob," I said. "We have work to do. You been listening?"
"Yeah, yeah," Bob said, his eyelights flickering to life. "Island go boom or something."
"We're on a mission to find out what it's going to do, and why, and how we can stop it."
"Gosh, I'd never have thought of that myself, Harry."
"This is top secret stuff," I said. "Anything you learn here is for me and you only. You go to someone else, I want this whole evening locked away someplace nice and tight. And don't go splitting off another personality on me like you did with evil Bob."
"Entirely confidential, check," Bob said.
"And it would take a lot more than one night working with you to build up enough momentum to spin off a whole new me. I have to actually learn things to make that happen." "Less insult, more analysis," I said. The beams from the skull's eye sockets grew brighter. They swept left and right, up and down, panning around like prison searchlights. Bob made thoughtful noises. I tended the coffee pot. After it had been boiling for a few minutes, I took it off the fire, added a splash of cold water from the pump to settle the grounds, and poured myself a cup. I added a little powdered creamer and a bunch of sugar.
"Might as well drink syrup," Bob muttered.
"Says the guy with no taste buds," I said. I sipped. "Been meaning to have you out here to take a look at the place anyway."
"Uh-huh," Bob said absently.
"So?" I asked.
Bob said. "I'm still working on the surface layer of spells on the stones of this cottage, Harry."
I frowned.
What?
"You know there's symbols there, right?" I sipped coffee.
"Sure,"
I said. "They kind of lit up when
nauseating, mind-numbing horror and pain flashed over my thoughts for a couple of seconds.
I'd used my wizard's sight to look at the wrong being a couple of years ago, and that isn't the kind of mistake you ever live down. Now the memory of seeing that thing's true being was locked into my noggin, and it wouldn't go away or fade into the past, not ever. That's bad. But the really bad part is that I have gotten used to it. It just caused a stutter step in my speech. The Negloshi tried to get inside. It didn't seem to like them much."
"I should fucking think not," Bob said, his voice nervous.
Harry, I don't know what these are."
I frowned at him.
"Oh, what?"
"I don't know," he repeated.
He sounded genuinely surprised.
"I don't know what they are, Harry."
Magic is like a lot of other disciplines that people have recently begun developing, in historic terms. Working with magic is a way of understanding the universe and how it functions. You can approach it from a lot of different angles, applying a lot of different theories and mental models to it. You can get to the same place through a lot of different lines of theory and reasoning, kind of like really advanced mathematics. There's no truly right or wrong way to get there, either. There are just different ways. some more or less useful than others for a given application. And new vistas of thought, theory, and application open up on a pretty regular basis, as the art develops and expands through the participation of multiple brilliant minds. But that said, once you have a good grounding in it, you get a pretty solid idea of what's possible and what isn't. No matter how much circumlocution you do with your formulae, 2 + 2 doesn't equal 5. Except maybe very, very rarely, sometimes, in extremely specific and highly unlikely circumstances. Magic isn't something that just makes things happen, poof. There are laws to how it behaves, structure, limits. And the whole reason Bob was created was so that those limits could be explored, tested, and charted. I could count on the fingers of no hands how many times Bob had come up completely dry. He always knew something. The skull had been working with wizards for centuries. He'd run into damn near everything. What? I said. Seriously? Nothing?
They're powerful, he said. I can tell you that much. But they're also complex. I mean, like, Molly on her best day could not come close to weaving together something this crazy.
You, on your best day, could not sling around enough power to juice up one of the smallest stones.
And that's just the first layer. I think there are more. Maybe a lot more. Like hundreds.
On each stone?
Yeah.
You can't put that much magic into that little space, I protested.
No, I can't, Bob said. And no, you can't. Because it's impossible. But, someone doesn't care.
How did they do it?
If I knew that, it wouldn't be impossible, Bob said, an edge to his voice. But I can tell you this much. It predates wizardry as we know it.
I would have said, what? But I felt like I'd been saying that a lot already. So I sipped coffee and scowled interrogatively instead.
This work, the actual spells on the stone, come from before even the predecessors to the White Council. I'm conversant in the course and application of the art since the Golden Age of Greece. This stuff, whatever it is, it's older.
You can't lay out spells that last that long, I mumbled. It isn't possible.
A lot of that going around, Bob said. Harry, we're talking about a whole different level here, one that I didn't even know existed. Do you get what that means, in round terms at least?
I shook my head slowly.
Well, at least you're smart enough to know that, Bob said. Okay. You know the old chestnut about how sufficiently advanced science could be described only as magic?
Right, I said.
Well, I'm going to use the same model right now. As a wizard, you're pretty good at making wooden axles and stone wheels. These spells? They're an internal combustion engine. You do the math from there, on your metaphorical abacus, I guess.
I blew out a very long, very slow breath. Hell's bells. I suddenly felt very young and very arrogant. And not terribly bright. I mean, I'd known I was going to be out of my depth when I first hooked up with the island, but I thought I'd at least be in the same freaking ocean. Instead, I was in uncharted space, wasn't I? And the best part of this whole conversation? Those spells that had stymied one of the most advanced research tools known to wizardry and baffled the collected knowledge of centuries. Those were just the ruined part of the island. What the hell was I going to find in the part that was working? One second I was alone in the ruined cottage, and the next there was a presence filling the doorway, looking down at me through the empty space where the roof should have been. It was huge, maybe 12 feet tall, and roughly humanoid in shape. I couldn't see much of it. It was covered in what looked like a heavy cloak that covered it completely. 2 points of green fire burned from within the cloak's hood. It simply stood, unnaturally still, staring down at me, though the cool night breeze over the lake stirred the edges of its cloak. Demon Reach, the manifested spirit of the island.
I said. Hi. The burning eyes shifted from me to Bob on the table, and then Demon Reach did something it had never done before. It spoke. Out loud. Its voice was a rumble of heavy rocks scraping together, of summer thunder rolling in from over the horizon. The voice was huge. Not loud. That didn't do it justice. It just came from everywhere, all at once. The surface of my partly drunk coffee buzzed and vibrated at the all-pervasive sound.
Another one.
Meep!
Bob squeaked. The lights vanished from the eye sockets of the skull. I blinked a bunch of times. You're talking now.
Necessity.
Right, I said. So, you're having some trouble, I guess.
Trouble?
It said.
Yes.
I came to help, I said, feeling extremely lame as I did. Is that even possible?
Potentially,
came the answer. Then the vast form turned. It took a limping step. The ground didn't so much tremble at the weight as shift slightly beneath the sheer, overwhelming presence of the ancient spirit.
Follow. Bring the memory, spirit.
Meep!
Bob whimpered. I grabbed the skull in shaking hands and stuffed it into the messenger bag. I grabbed a chemical light from the storage boxes on the table, snapped it, and shook it to life as I hurried to catch up. I had an instinct about where we were headed, but I asked to be sure. Where are we going? Demon Reach kept walking, slow paces that nonetheless forced me to scurry to keep up.
Below.
The spirit walked to the ruined circle of the lighthouse and lifted a shadowy arm in a vague gesture. When it did, the ground of the circle rippled and quivered. And then what had appeared to be solid stone began to run down, pouring itself down into a hole, like sand falling through an hourglass. In seconds, an opening the size of the trapdoor to my old lab had formed in the stone, and stairs led down into the darkness. Oh, I said. I'd known there were caves beneath the island, but not how I'd gotten there or where I could find them. Wow! What's the game plan here, exactly?
The well is under attack,
came the surround sound answer.
It must be defended.
It started toward the stairs. There was no way it should have fit down them, but it moved as though that wasn't going to be an issue. Wait, you want me to fight off something you can't stop? I asked.
It is time for you to understand.
Understand what?
Our purpose, Warden, it said. Follow me.
Then it went down the stairs and vanished into the unknown.
Here there be monsters,
Bob whispered half hysterically.
Run! Run already!
Think it's a little late for that, I said. But for a second there, I thought about taking his advice. Some part of me wondered what Tibet looked like this time of year. For a minute, it seemed like an awesome idea to go find out. But only for a minute. Then I swallowed, gripped the plastic glow stick in fingers that felt very slippery for some reason, and followed Demon Reach down into the dark. Chapter 16. I don't know how far down those stairs went. I'm not even kidding. I'm not taking poetic license. The stairs went down 12 steps, took a right angle, and went down 12 more, took another right-angled turn, and went down 12 more, and so on. I stopped counting in the low 200s and resorted to my awareness of the island to feel out the rest of them. Duh. 1728. 12 cubed. The stairs were about 8 inches each, which meant 1,100 feet and change, straight down. That was well below the water level of the lake. Hell, it was below the bottom of the lake. The staircase echoed with deep, groaning sounds, pitched almost too low to be heard. In the wan light of the chemical glow stick, it took on a kind of amusement park funhouse atmosphere, where you suddenly realized that you'd been routed into a circle with no apparent way out. I sang a few lines of Down, Down to Goblin Town in a hearty, badly pitched baritone. Demon Reach's glowing eyes flicked toward me, maybe irritated.
"Oh, come on," I said. "You never saw the Rankin-Bass animated version of The Hobbit? The one they made before they did the movies in New Zealand?"
It didn't answer.
"Harry," Bob muttered at me, "stop trying to piss it off."
"I'm bored," I said, "and I'm not looking forward to coming back up. I get that we're going a long, long way down, but couldn't we use an elevator? Whew, or a fireman's pole? Then it'd be like going down to the Bat Cave. Way more fun." I raised my voice a little. "And more efficient." Maybe it was my imagination, but when I said that last, I thought I saw Demon Reach's steady pace slow for a thoughtful second or two.
"Nah."
"Hey, how come you called me Warden?" I asked. "I mean, I've been a warden, but there are a lot of other guys who are better at it than me. I'm not exactly the poster child."
"Warden," Demon Reach said. "Now there are many. First, there was one."
I counted down the last 10 steps out loud, stopped at 2, and jumped over the last one to the floor beneath with both feet. My hiking boots clomped on the stone. We had reached a small chamber, the floor and walls lined in the same stone used in the lighthouse and cottage. I put a hand on them and could feel them quivering with power, with a dissonance of conflicting energies. Actually, looking back, I saw that at some point the walls of the stairway and the stairs themselves had begun to be constructed of the same material, every single stone of it invested with impossible amounts of power and skill.
I said, "question?"
Demon Reach had stopped at a stone doorway shape in the wall. It was surrounded with larger stones covered in intricate carving. The burning eyes turned toward me.
Who made this place?"
It didn't speak. It pointed to the door. I looked. There was a sign in the middle of it, a sigil. It wasn't something I recognized as part of any set of runes that I knew, but I knew I'd seen it somewhere before. It took me several seconds of sorting through memories to run it down. I'd seen it on the spine of a very, very, very old journal on my mentor's bookshelf.
"Merlin," I said quietly. "That's whose sign that is, isn't it?"
Demon Reach did not respond. Why say yes when silence will do? I swallowed. The original Merlin was the real deal, Arthur and Excalibur and everything. Merlin had, according to legend, created the White Council of Wizards from the chaos of the fall of the Roman Empire. He plunged into the flames of the burning Library of Alexandria to save the most critical texts, helped engineer the Catholic Church as a vessel to preserve knowledge and culture during Europe's Dark Ages, and leapt tall cathedrals in a single bound. There were endless stories about Merlin. Popular theory among contemporary wizards was that they were more apocryphal than accurate. Hell, I'd always figured it that way, too. But staring around at this place, I suddenly felt less sure.
"Watch."
Demon Reach stretched out one long arm, still shadowy and indistinct in the feeble light of my glow stick. It touched one of the stones framing the door, and the stone erupted into emerald light. I hissed and shielded my eyes against it, and took note of the fact that the air suddenly crackled with power. Demon Reach touched a second stone, which also began to glow. When it did, the sense of building energy was palpable in the air, and the hairs on my arms began to stand up. That was when I got what was happening here. Demon Reach had wards around whatever was beyond the door, much like the wards that had been put into position around Butters's apartment. Only they had to be fueled with freaking mystic plutonium or something to generate this much ambient energy simply from being bypassed. The giant spirit reached for another stone, but paused before touching it.
Remember.
The stones. They were like a security keypad. Demon Reach was giving me the combination to its security system. And given how much dangerous energy was in the air right now, it stood to reason that if I ever got the combination wrong, well, you'd need a bloodhound, a Ouija board, a forensic anthropologist, and a small army of little folk to find what was left of me. I took careful note of which stones the spirit had indicated. Really careful note. Demon Reach touched the last stone, and the granite doorway in front of us didn't move, exactly. It simply stopped being there. The leashed violence in the air, that angry, watchful energy, dwindled and vanished, and Demon Reach moved forward through the doorway. I followed. We emerged into a familiar cavern, and once again my chest lit up with phantom remembered pain. It was surprisingly well lit for a subterranean chamber. When I'd last been there, I hadn't been in any shape to go over the details, but I could now see that several glimmering clusters of crystal in the floor, some kind of pale green quartz, maybe, gave off a dim glow. No single patch of them really provided adequate illumination, but as a whole, they filled most of the cavern with wan, green-white light. Roots burrowed down into the cavern through its ceiling, though I had no idea how in the hell they'd gotten there. No plant sent roots down as deep beneath the surface as this chamber. No normal earthly plant did, anyway. Water dripped slowly down from above, and where it fell from the ceiling was where the patches of crystal lay. Over to one side of the chamber was a hollowed-out section of soft earth, no deeper than a very shallow bathtub, about 7 feet long. I recognized it, even without seeing the withered vines that lay strewn, forgotten, all around the area. It was my sick bed, where my body had lain for months while Mab and Demon Reach exerted themselves to keep the pumps working, while my mind and spirit were doing a Casper impersonation. My chest panged again, and I looked away. Waking up from that particular nap had been one of the top 2 or 3 most painful moments of my life. Something inside me had changed, not because of the pain of the experience, though that had been profound. Staring at that place, I felt as if the pain had been a side effect of a deeper and more significant shift in the way I thought of myself, saw myself, and how I should interact with my world. Fire isn't always an element of destruction. Classical alchemical doctrine teaches that it also has dominion over another province. Change. The fire of my tribulations had not simply been pain to be endured. It had been an agent of transformation. After all that I'd been through, I'd changed. Not for the worse, I was pretty sure, at least not yet. But only a moron or a freaking lunatic could have faced the things I had and remained unfazed by them. I blinked myself out of my reverie to find Demon Reach watching me. There was something intense about its eyes.
Memory,
it said.
Reflection.
I frowned. What do you mean?
This place.
I pondered that one for a minute. Are you saying that I just went into an internal monologue because I came in here? Demon Reach did not seem to feel a need to clarify.
Memory. Reflection.
I sighed. Well, if I ever need to mull things over, I know just where to go, I guess. It was chilly in the cavern, and damp, and the air was thick with musty, earthy smells. I turned a slow circle, surveying the entire chamber. What do you call this place? Demon Reach said nothing and did not move. Right, I said. You don't call it anything at all, I guess. I scrunched up my nose, thinking. What is this chamber's purpose?
Containment.
I frowned. Of what?
The least.
The least what? I asked, feeling exasperated. Demon Reach just watched me.
Harry,
Bob said in a small voice,
maybe you should look at the crystals.
I glanced down at the skull, shrugged, and walked over to the nearest formation. I stood over it for a moment. It was a large clump, maybe 12 feet long and 4 or 5 across. And the shadows passing through the translucent crystals seemed to indicate that the floor beneath it had been hollowed out, much the same as my own recovery bed. In fact, I frowned, leaning closer. There was a form beneath the crystals, an outline. The image of whatever it was got to me only after being refracted through multiple crystals, so it was awfully blurry. But I peered at it, trying to unfocus my eyes and look past it, the way you do those magic paintings at the mall. The image suddenly snapped into disjointed clarity. The form beneath the crystal was a lean creature of basically human shape, maybe 9 or 10 feet tall and lithe, covered in shaggy hair of golden brown. Its arms were too long for its body. Its hands were too big for its arms. Its fingers were too long for its hands, and were tipped with vicious claws. And its yellow, gold eyes were open, aware, staring at me in naked, undisguised hatred. "Fuck me!" I shouted, staggering back in pure, panicked reflex. "That's a Negloshi! That's a fucking Negloshi!" Negloshi were bad news. Serious bad news. Originally divine messengers of the Dine's holy people, they had turned their backs on their origins and become the legendary skinwalkers of the American Southwest. I went up against one of them once. It killed one of my friends, tortured my brother half crazy, and left me with permanent psychic scars before beating the ever-loving snot out of me. The only reason I had survived was that the wizard, who was the greatest shapeshifter I had ever seen, had intervened. Listens to Wind had taken on the Negloshi head to head. Even then, it had been close, and the Negloshi had escaped to fight another day. I've run into cruel and dangerous beings before, but the Negloshi were quite simply among the most evil creatures it had ever been my displeasure to encounter. And one of the damn things was staring at me from beneath the fragile layer of quartz I could have smashed with a wrench, its eyes burning like it was going to eat me whole. I got a sudden sinking feeling, and I turned around to the next mound of quartz, and the next. I'm a lucky guy. I didn't have one of the most nightmarish fiends in circulation lying on the floor within pouncing distance. I had 6 of them. There were more shapes beneath more crystal mounds. I didn't recognize them. I'm pretty sure I was extremely happy that I didn't. "The least," I said, my voice shaking. "You're telling me that a Negloshi is one of the least?" I felt like sitting down, so I did, sort of abruptly, onto the floor. What else is in here? Demon Reach turned to a wall. It lifted an arm and the stone of the wall faded into non-existence, revealing a hallway maybe 50 feet across. I got back up onto my shaky legs again to take a look. The tunnel sloped down gently and was lit by the wan glow of the crystals. Lots of crystals. Lots and lots and lots of crystals. The tunnel stretched into the distance. Maybe it was a mile long. Maybe 2. Maybe it ran all the way down to hell. Mounds of crystals dotted the tunnel at regular intervals. Some of them were the size of buildings. Some of the individual crystals had to be the size of freaking trees. I had barely gotten my gawk on when a flood of energy smashed into me, as though opening the door had released liquid held back under pressure. The energy had no physical presence, but I felt a nauseating wave of greasy cold flooding through me, the dark power of the ley lines that converged upon the island, breathing across me like a cloud of invisible smog. "The well," Demon Reach said. The spirit turned slowly, and 11 more doorways to tunnels almost identical to the first one sighed into existence. 11 more of them.
because one infinite tunnel full of horrors obviously wasn't enough.